From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Full moon tonight. Look out. Next hour, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us. Stories of high strangeness, followed by, of course, conversations with Linda when we take your phone calls. Here's what's happening. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has said that the Boston Marathon bombing suspects plan to detonate the rest of their explosives in Times Square. Mayor Bloomberg said the surviving suspect had told the FBI that he and his brother spontaneously decided that New York would be next. Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly told reporters the suspects had a pressure cooker bomb and five pipe bombs. Three people died and more than 260 were wounded and the April 15th Boston attack. Now, the Department of Homeland Security is reserving the right to buy up to 750 million rounds of ammunition over the next 5 years and currently has 2 years' worth of ammo on hand, or about 247 million rounds in its inventory. Homeland Security has 72,000 officers. Top-ranking lawmakers on both sides of the aisle declared that the red line in Syria has been crossed, calling for strong U.S. and international intervention after administration officials revealed that the intelligence community believes chemical weapons were used against rebels. Stay tuned for more on that one. There is some problem, though, because of the fiasco going into Iraq with the weapons of mass destruction. Whether people believe that Syria indeed used chemical weapons, still up in the air. Mortgage rates continuing to drop, the 15-year fixed-rate loan hitting a record low, according to a weekly report from Freddie Mac, the 15-year fixed rate falling to 2.61%. With flight delays mounting, the Senate has approved hurry-up legislation to end air traffic controller furloughs, blamed for inconveniencing large numbers of travelers. A House vote on the measure was expected as early as Friday morning, with lawmakers eager to embark on a week-long vacation. Under the legislation, the FAA would gain authority to transfer up to $253 million from accounts that are flush into other programs to prevent reduced operations and staffing through at least September 30th. The Senate has approved a measure that would let states tax retailers based in other states when those retailers sell to their own residents. In other words, states may soon get the green light to tax e-commerce. Lauren Weinstein, who watches the internet for us. Lauren, what do you think of this? States need money. Is this an easy way to do it?
Yeah, well, the argument all along has been that the internet should be on equal footing with brick and mortar ordinary stores that people go into where they would ordinarily pay sales tax where they are. The argument against this has been that the internet was new, and another argument that still isn't enforced right now is that the different states have such complicated laws concerning sales tax. Every state's a little bit different. The question was how would an e-commerce site, for example, deal with all these different laws? I think this is going to happen, though. Amazon has already pretty much said they're going to go along with this. Other big internet firms that have physical presence in states have been doing it. The legislation that's now going through appears to be aimed at firms that have retail sales of, I think it's a million and above right now, and it supposedly requires that there be more simplification of the laws in various states before it can take effect. I suspect by the time they're done with it, maybe that $1 million will be a little higher, maybe it won't. Maybe there'll be some more specifics on how the simplification is going to work. But I think it's going to happen. I think people have to be planning to start paying sales tax for their internet purchases, at least to firms that aren't relatively small.
Well, you know, Lauren, the internet is garnering now billions of dollars in sales that they have siphoned off from the, as you say, brick-and-mortar retailers. I don't want to pay any more taxes, but a use tax, a sales tax, to me is fair only because it's unfair to the retailers.
I think most people looking at this would say that if you're going to pay it in the store, you should probably pay it online. I think the question here is what happens to the smaller businesses that just can't deal with it logistically, and I think that's why that $1 million floor is set there. So for mom and pop businesses that don't reach $1 million in sales, they're not going to have to deal with this. And I suspect online, you know, online systems that will make it easier for the larger ones to do it. And I think this is something whose time has come. None of us like to pay more on purchases, but we do want to be fair.
We shall watch what happens. It's only in the future. Thank you so much. Drinking one or more cans of sugary soft drinks a day is linked to an increased risk of diabetes in later life, according to a study. Be careful. A can a day raises the relative risk of type 2 diabetes by about a fifth compared with one can a month or under, according to scientists in Europe. At least 73 people in 18 states have been sickened with salmonella poisoning after eating cucumbers imported from Mexico. The potentially tainted cukes have been removed from the market, and the two firms involved were placed on an import alert list, according to the CDC. The biggest concentrations of victims clustered in western states included 28 people from California, 9 from Arizona, 14 people have been hospitalized. Reports show that illnesses occurred between January 12th and April 6th of this year, though more could still be detected. Let's check in with food safety expert Jeff Nelken. Cucumbers, Jeff, of all things?
Well, you know, again, you know, it's something they identified it as Salmonella St. Paul, so they pretty much know what they're looking for in the way of description. Now the question is, what happened? What was the cause? Just to our listeners, again, to make sure that if they purchase cucumbers, make sure those cucumbers are in good condition. Don't buy any bruised items because the salmonella tends to get into the bruises. And important, again, you know, to make sure that we wash our cucumbers and, you know, be careful on how you consume those cucumbers.
So, Jeff, nearly all the time, the salmonella, the E. coli, gets in from the outside, right? It's not that the vegetable, the plant, kind of gets contaminated in its seed formation, and then it's already in there, right?
Rarely, you know, that's happened with sprouts, you know, where the seeds were contaminated. But generally, it's, as you're describing, it's somewhere in the field, or maybe, you know, some birds flew over, or some of the workers mishandled product, or some of the water could have been contaminated. So, you know, we still have to investigate the source.
Jeff's website, foodsafetycoach.com. I go there all the time. He's got some great tips there. Now, here's a story. This one's a tough one. If you don't want to listen to it, it's going to last about 20 seconds. Cover your ears for just a second. Chilean police have arrested 4 people accused of burning a baby alive in a ritual because the leader of the sect believes that the end of the world was near and that the child was the Antichrist. The 3-day-old baby was taken to a hill in the town of Culaguay near the Chilean port of Valparaiso and was thrown into a bonfire. The baby's mother, a 25-year-old, had approved the sacrifice and was among those arrested. Man. And transportation security officials found pottery filled with dirt and human skull fragments inside a carry-on bag at the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport. 2 women heading to Baltimore were carrying the bag on the AirTrain flight. The passengers were Santeria priestesses from Baltimore who traveled to Cuba for religious training. The women said they purchased the pots at a religious shop, saying that they are for protection. Get up to the coasttocoastam.com website. If you got a quick second, take a look at the ghost picture that Joshua P. Warren has sent along. It is an amazing photograph recently discovered after 42 years that was stuffed in a drawer. We will talk with him about the lady on a staircase at the Reynolds Mansion in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Joshua P. Warren has spent 20 years breaking ground on the paranormal, hosting his own program, Speaking of Strange, and is considered an expert, and he is, on ghosts, cryptids, UFOs, and all things that just aren't normal. You're not normal, Josh. How are you?
Well, you know, it's funny because the more popular the paranormal becomes, the more normal I become. I don't know if I like that or not, but I feel good.
You've been kicking around this for, gosh, how many years now?
I have been professionally working in the paranormal field for over 20 years, and that's a long time if you consider I got started when I was a teenager. And but on the other hand, I was perfectly timed there to be able to take advantage of this burst in technology when, you know, suddenly there are cameras everywhere, you can get infrared technology available at your fingertips, and that's why it's so amazing to me when you can find a photograph like this one that was taken the old-fashioned way on this thing called film. You might remember that, George.
I do.
And yet it's been in a drawer for 42 years.
42 years.
Yeah,
now, I want you to describe, for people, Josh, who haven't had a chance to get up to our website through your link, kind of describe, if you can, the Reynolds Wraith photograph.
Absolutely. Well, Lex has posted a close-up of the upper body of this phantom, and if you want to see the full picture and analysis, that's posted at joshuapwarren.com. There is no period after the P at joshuapwarren.com. But let me tell you a bit about this location, because this is one of the most fascinating locations that I've ever encountered. I've been doing research there for years, and the Reynolds Mansion in Asheville, North Carolina, was built in 1847. It's one of the oldest buildings around. And there are plenty of peculiar relationships between this place and the paranormal. Now, sure, I could talk about the Civil War or the fact that they used it for years as an embalming facility, but my favorite story that really gives you an idea of how strange this place is relates to Asheville's largest mass murder killing spree. And that happened on November 13th of 1906. This very evil man who had committed about every crime you can imagine, named Will Harris, escaped from prison here in North Carolina and found his way to Asheville. He was trying to find an old girlfriend of his, but she didn't want to have anything to do with him. And he became very intoxicated, and he bought a rifle and went on a killing spree around our town that evening, shooting at everything that moved. He started by killing a police officer. But at one point, when Will Harris was on his shooting spree, he turned a corner, and he was in front of a club called the Old British American Club. And there was a gentleman in that club, a judge named Spears Reynolds. And Judge Spears Reynolds always carried a revolver in his vest pocket.
Smart man.
So Judge Spears Reynolds came out into the street and started shooting at Will Harris. And Will Harris is shooting at him, and they're shooting back and forth across the street, and one is not hitting the other. Finally, Will Harris landed a shot that was so close, these brick chips kind of flew down onto the judge, and the judge says, okay, that's enough. So Will Harris went on to kill five people until he was killed himself by a mob. And everybody considered Judge Spears Reynolds to be the luckiest man in Asheville. He was a figure of good luck. Well, the irony is that years later, his younger brother, Robert Reynolds, became a U.S. senator from Asheville and was a very popular man. But when Senator Robert Reynolds married his fifth and final wife, she was the daughter of Evelyn Walsh McLean, who was the last private owner of the Hope Diamond. And so Evelyn Walsh McLean came to the Reynolds Mansion with the Hope Diamond. And after this, all kinds of horrible things happened to the family. Her daughter died of a drug overdose. Her son was killed in a car accident. The family business, the Washington Post, went bankrupt. Her husband ran off with another woman and then died in a sanatorium. And then Evelyn McLean Walsh herself died.
The curse was
in a short period of time. So when many people think about the so-called curse of the Hope Diamond, they're really thinking about many of these events they've heard of that took place around Asheville and the Reynolds Mansion. So we know, of course, that layers of emotional energy become power supplies for ghosts to manifest. So after everything I just told you, Senator Robert Reynolds' aunt was a woman named Anne Lee Reynolds. She was born in 1857. She died in 1915 when she was in her late 50s. And she died in the room at the top of the third floor, on the top of the staircase there. And for years, people have seen Annalee Reynolds' ghost on this staircase. She's one of these, you know, examples of just a lady in a dress on a staircase. And I've heard all kinds of reports at the Reynolds Mansion. You know, you have guests that say, I was trying to get in the front door. I don't know why that lady on the stairs wouldn't let me in. You know, we were banging on the door, that kind of thing. And so you can imagine how blown away I was, George, when I was recently at the Reynolds Mansion. And I was told by Billy, who is one of the co-owners there now, that he had recently been talking to the lady who owned the mansion before him. And from 1970 to 1972, that lady was doing some renovations in the inn. And as she was completing those, she was inviting friends of hers to come and stay in the rooms. Well, one of these friends in 1971 snapped the photograph that we're talking about. And this woman, who was the previous owner, saw the photograph and thought, wow, that's interesting, and then put it away in a drawer. For 42 years, I saw this photograph, and I could not believe it.
And I've got to tell you, in those days, you know, obviously no Photoshop, no manipulation of pictures. It is what it is, Josh.
Well, you know, obviously since the dawn of photography, people have been out there trying to manipulate pictures. You see some of these Victorian era images that have, you know, blatant sort of effects inserted. But in this particular case, you know, we've looked at, and we're still examining the photo. We're, you know, it's unfinished, but we have found that there is no blatant evidence of any sort of fishy photographic trickery. Furthermore, we have all of the details regarding where the photo came from, what the conditions were. We know that its origin is from 1971. And therefore, it doesn't make sense for this to be something that was just created to fake everybody out. And when I saw this photo, it immediately resonated with these pictures like the Brown Lady of Raynham Hall, or the Newbie Phantom, or the Tulip Staircase, or some of these other very classic ghost photographs that were taken decades ago and on good old-fashioned film. And the great thing is when you look at the full picture on my website, you can see the folds of the dress and the density as it changes the light going through it. And it's just, it's a striking and clear image.
That's amazing stuff, Josh. In your history of looking at all these kinds of photographs, how would you categorize and rate this one?
Oh, my goodness. I would categorize this as a 9 out of 10.
That's huge.
Yeah, and that's because, I mean, especially when you look at the enhancements on the website, and also you can see a picture of Annalee Reynolds when she was a teenager. When you look at it, you immediately know what it's supposed to be. See, that's a big factor for me. If you can stop somebody on the street, a stranger who has no idea what you have or what you're talking about, and you can say, what does this look like? And a stranger says, well, it's a lady on a dress, in a dress on the stairs. That's when you've got a good photo. Same with EVP, in my opinion. You know, if you can have someone listen to it and tell you what you think it hears without you telling them first, that's a big deal. The only way I would give it a 10 out of 10 is if we could actually see more of the specific facial details, if you could actually see the eyes and the nose and the mouth. And, of course, in some cases, these apparitions are so well materialized that those who see them do not realize at first this is a ghost. I hear stories all the time about people who say, you know, I was sitting there in my living room eating potato chips and watching TV. I turn over and it scares me half to death. There's a guy standing there wearing a bowler hat, and I figure somebody's broken into my house. And then I realize that the level of the floor is at his knees. He's not standing at the current level of the floor. This apparition is attached to the construction of the building at a different point in time, and then the ghost disappears. And so if it weren't for these little cues, you might not even know at first you're seeing a ghost, and that's why sometimes you might be walking down the street, and you just glance over for 2 seconds at somebody, and you may think the person looks a bit odd or something, but you may have no idea how many times you've seen a ghost ghost just walking down a street, especially in some old historic town.
It just might look out of place, but it's just strange indeed. Josh, we're going to take phone calls with you when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast. Questions for Joshua Warn. Plus, here's an opportunity to talk to one of the most preeminent researchers in the field of the paranormal. So we'll take your calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We'll take your calls this remaining half hour with Joshua Warn. Joshua, what's ParanormalPuertoRico.com? You're a new website?
Well, thanks for asking about that, George. And by the way, I have to give my usual disclaimer here. Your audience is so enormous. I want everybody to know, if you try to go to the website and you have difficulty, my webmaster is sitting there refreshing it, and we're going to keep the photo up there all night so everybody can get in and see it. Paranormal Puerto Rico is a site devoted to the expeditions that I am doing the rest of this year down to the Bermuda Triangle.
Uh-huh.
We just got back from one, and I've been working for years to set up the world's first really effective 24-hour-a-day Bermuda Triangle research base, and I started around San Juan, Puerto Rico. And the problem is, however, that there's a lot of light pollution there, and so now I'm sort of shifting to some other parts of the island. But, you know, I'll tell you something that I think that you will really appreciate. I just got back a few days ago from the last expedition. I took a group of seven people with me, and I also brought some third-generation night vision goggles.
Awesome.
And none of the people with me had ever seen UFOs before.
Amazing, isn't it?
Within an hour, every single one of them saw UFOs. And I'm not talking about, you know, just the little dots flying around. I mean, crazy things they could see in the sky.
Stopping, 90-degree turns, all that.
It's incredible. And there's something about, you know, this place called the Bermuda Triangle that is a real, tangible, measurable phenomenon. It goes all the way back to Columbus in 1492, you know, writing down in his journal about these strange lights and his compass going haywire. So, you know, I'm going to be spending a lot of time down there. I'm going to sort of be bouncing back and forth between Puerto Rico and Asheville this year. And if any of your listeners would like to spend, a few days or a week with me, go to ParanormalPuertoRico.com and just take a look at all the things that we do. It's an amazing adventure.
It sure is. Let's take a few calls here with you, Josh. Nashville, Tennessee, we go east of the Rockies. Charles with us. Hello, Charles. Go ahead.
And yes, Joshua, I was looking at the image on the Coast to Coast website, and that image, the woman is looking like she's walking away from the camera, and if you look at it, to me, it looks like she's her head is like she's going down to a older, like a hall, a darkened hallway, and you can see the bundle, how women wear their hair back in the old days on top of her head and her hair. And on her left shoulder, if she's walking away, it's like a ruffly kind of dress, and it's down on her arm, and on her right side, the ruffles is on top of her dress. I mean, that's what it looks to me, but, I know it.
You know, Charles, I actually agree with you. I think that that's a great description. I think that she is walking away from the camera and that she has her hair up in a bun.
Yep.
And of course, especially when you see the complete version of the photo, you can actually see how the dress is kind of falling on the stairs behind her.
Yep.
And now, mind you, if she is walking away from the camera, the room immediately to her left is the room she died in. And, of course, from the photographs, it's impossible to determine what the age of the apparition may be in terms of the way it would appear. But since those who actually see this phantom in person, what we call the Reynolds Wraith, say that she appears to be young, that means one of two things. Either, one, this is an imprint of Ann Lee Reynolds from a dramatic moment when she was that age. So that's how she was sort of captured, but she's not conscious necessarily. It's almost like looking at some type of a movie.
Like an astral body, out of body. It looks to me, this picture, was it taken in the room or in the hall?
Well, before we get to that, the second thing is that this could be an entity, a conscious entity, and that it is choosing, she is choosing to be seen as young. But she's standing at the top of the staircase, and so the photographer is at the, not the very bottom, but about halfway down.
So is there anything, say, if the photographer is at the
first standing at the top?
Okay, and she's at the top. Okay, when you go, if you ever been there at the top of the staircase, Joshua?
Yeah.
To the right, is there any room? It looks like if she would come up the stairs, and she was turning her head over, looking towards the right, down the hall, and maybe, and her body looks like she's moving towards the left, but she sees something towards the right. And, you know, and she stopped for a moment. Maybe at that moment, something traumatic happened, and that it's like a loop that keeps she's going up the stairs, and let's say she gets killed.
Well, yeah, you know, that's an interesting point because you can sort of see there's a light that comes in from the right. There used to be a window there. Now, since then, there has been some construction done, and they've added on some stuff. So there's no longer a window at that spot. But you could almost say that she may be looking out the window and seeing something. When I was there last time, I actually I had a friend with me, a lady who is 5'6". And she stood at that exact spot, and she looked pretty close to the height of the lady in the picture. And I plan on going back and doing some even more detailed sort of recreations, taking, a woman wearing a dress and actually putting her there. I've had a lot of success using that to recreate, say, one of the photos that's famous from the Myrtles Plantation in Louisiana. And those kinds of things will give us all the more, you know, realistic details that we need to compare to this young woman, Ann Lee Reynolds. And even though Ann Lee died in that room in 1915, it is unclear why she died. We haven't found any record of how she died.
Are we getting more paranormal reports these days, Joshua? And if so, why?
We certainly are, George. And this is not at all surprising to me. I feel like that, I guess it was something like a couple years ago. The gentleman who won the Nobel Prize for Physics won that prize because they proved what has long been suspected, and that is that our universe is accelerating, that things are moving faster. And as things accelerate, their frequency changes dramatically. It's just like when you you stomp down on the accelerator in your car, and things start to get very, very shaky, and they start vibrating very fast, and then things begin to move and rattle around, and tiny little things like a pebble are magnified into a bigger effect. Well, right now we are reaching this very critical point, and I think this ties into some of the 2012 philosophy. The 2012 was just a good kind of general date for people to sort of think about this acceleration that's happening. As the frequencies of the universe are moving faster, that means that, well, we are part of the universe. We think of the universe as just a bunch of rocks flying through space, but that's not true. It is that, but it's also me and you and this room that we're standing in. We're all a part of this thing. So we're moving faster. And as we move faster, it's changing our relationship to these other energy fields that maybe were previously in a phase that was a little bit out of sync with ours. And now we're going through a natural cycle where we come back in phase with each other. And I think this has happened many times throughout history. It happened in the range of 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, certainly, when a lot of the modern religions were being formed because people were having these profound spiritual experiences. And so we now happen to be going through this cycle where we are coming back into this sympathetic resonance with these frequencies and the bridge, the gap, you could say, between things that have been non-physical to us is becoming narrower and narrower And I absolutely predict that based upon what I'm seeing and based upon how we are now understanding the composition of the universe and this dimension as we know it, we are going to see an acceleration and a convergence of these other dimensions over certainly the next 100 years. I think we're probably in a phase that can go on for hundreds of years. And so This is the time when truly the paranormal is shifting into the normal.
Yeah, I think you're right, Josh. Let's go next to Ian in Seattle, Washington. First time caller. Hello, Ian. Good morning.
Good morning, George. Hi, Josh.
Hi.
I'm actually originally from Asheville, so when I heard you talk about the Reynolds Mansion, I was wondering if it was actually the WLOS Mansion, or if it's a different one.
No, it's a different one. The WLOS Mansion was called the Battle Mansion, and
after
Samuel Westray Battle, who was a prominent doctor here, it was built in 1927, and that mansion is no longer standing, unfortunately. It was demolished a few years ago, and a similar building was built in its stead. So the Reynolds Mansion is from 1847, and it's closer to the Woodfin area.
Okay, right, okay. I should remember that. I remember growing up hearing a lot of things like the Blue Lady and a lot of the stuff from the area around there and like the Brown Mountain Lights and stuff. So it was like it was interesting when I heard the radio tonight. It's like, wait, I got to call in.
So. Well, I'm glad that you did, and you're right. You know, there are so many different ghostly things and spooky paranormal things that are associated with this part of the world. And, you know, I get asked frequently, why Asheville? Why so much here? Well, for one thing, we have not only the highest mountains east of the Mississippi, but these are the oldest mountains in North America. They are approximately the third oldest in the world. And so you have all of these incredibly old legends and myths and a lot of spiritualism that's rampant here. Additionally, we have some of the purest quartz in the world, quartz that's so pure. NASA has come here in the past and used our quartz to produce optics. And, of course, we know that quartz has this very interesting relationship with electricity, and we also know that electricity is an integral component of many of these paranormal phenomena. But furthermore, there's an alignment here. So if you were to take the city of Asheville here in the western part of North Carolina and draw a line going toward the east, toward the Atlantic Ocean, from Asheville you would pass through the area where we have the Brown Mountain Lights. And then you would also pass through a little further along a spot called the Devil's Tramping Ground, which is a big barren spot of land, and supposedly the devil walks in circles there at night and muses over how he will do terrible things to people. And finally, you continue that, you get to the coast where so many ships have sunk. They call it the graveyard of the Atlantic. Also, right off the coast, you have Roanoke Island, which was the very first island ever settled by the English there, and they all vanished, so it's now called the Lost Colony. Nobody knows what the heck happened to them. And if you continue extending that line out into the ocean, you eventually hit the island of Bermuda, one of the top three points there of the so-called Bermuda Triangle. So we are part of a very odd alignment here, and one that nourishes every type of paranormal phenomenon you can imagine.
Indeed. Let's go next, Chris. Idaho Falls, Idaho, west of the Rockies. Chris, you're on with Joshua. Go ahead.
Thanks, George.
Sure,
Josh, good to talk to you. I have a question. Do you have to have populations to see or go ghost hunting? There are so many ghost towns in Northwest, and nobody lives there, so nobody has seen ghosts. But wouldn't that be hot spots to go and look for ghosts and to try and experience and find the paranormal? I mean, I've tried it in a few times, but I think that there's a hotbed of things going on, but just because nobody lives there doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Am I right?
Yeah, well, Chris, you know, you're absolutely right, and it's very important for us to understand that anytime we go and investigate something paranormal, we are initially at that spot because we get a human report. You know, if somebody says, look, I saw this, I felt this, I captured this. It all begins with the human experience. And so there are no telling how many places there are out there that are haunted or paranormally active, but we just don't know about it because there aren't enough people running around. Another thing that's very odd is that based upon the research I've done into ghosts for so many years, I think that you can roughly sort of guesstimate how old a ghost may be by how it appears. Now, what I mean by that, when I say how old a ghost may be, I'm not talking about how old it appears to be when you see it. I'm talking about how long that spirit has been removed from the body. So, in other words, if a spirit has been removed from the body for a short period of time, it's a very crisp, clear apparition that looks very, very much like the body that it came from. Now, that can last for hundreds of years. You know, I've seen some ghosts from the Civil War that look, you know, in pictures and whatnot, that look incredibly clear.
How come they look like they never have legs, Josh?
Well, you know, that's a great question because, and of course, in other cases, you have ghosts that start to degrade, right?
Yeah.
So when they first pop out, they may look very clear. But what happens, George, is that over time, they begin to erode, you see. And it's almost like taking sand that's in a sandcastle mold and dumping it out. At first, it's nice and crisp, but then it begins to erode. And what you find is the extremities begin to erode first. So the legs and the arms and then the head starts to wear down. Everything eventually starts to look very misty. And then when it gets really, really old, it will just look like a ball. It takes on it sort of breaks down into a ball. So when you see a phantom that doesn't have arms or legs, it's either because that apparition has eroded to that point over time, or that the apparition is making a decision to view itself with or without legs. For example, right now, if you think of yourself, think of George Norrie for a second. When most people do that, they don't think of themselves and see their legs. And it's just one of those strange little phenomena. Most people don't think of themselves naked. And so, if you have to think about how you view yourself, because if how you view yourself impacts how you are able to present yourself to others, that's another reason that some of these apparitions may only be partial-bodied apparitions, because only those portions are being visualized that the apparition is self-aware of.
Josh, thanks again for bringing us such a stunning picture. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, George. It's wonderful to be able to share this with you and the audience, and I look forward to getting feedback from all the listeners.
You got it. Up next, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe, a number of stories of high strangeness. She's next.